You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Bieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. We have only some weeks to go to the Effective Statistician Conference with lots of webinars coming up. For example, Jess Thompson talk about risk management and projects for statisticians. And as you can know, in projects, many things can go south and can mess up your timelines, your budget, your quality, all these kind of different things. So I highly recommend you go to this interactive workshop with her. Of course, we also have some other more technical things, like Daniel Savanis will talk about statistical software engineering. Some colleagues from Bayer and Boehringer will talk about machine learning. We will have something about simulated and synthetic data generation. I will do something about data visualization. And we will also have something about self-leadership and leading others. Like we have things about self-management, we have something about leadership styles, and we have also something about personal productivity. So check out the increasing number of interactive workshops that are all included in the premium version of the conference. So check out the premium version. Of course, you can go for the free version, but I highly recommend you go for the premium version because it's so packed with lots of value. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about all the different PSI activities. Become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician. Today I'm talking again with Svana. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very good. It is awesome. I checked the editorial calendar and it is quite some time that you have been on the show, and we talked about how to think more strategically and why that is important for statisticians. And I think you have brought that strategic thinking to lots of other places beyond statistics nowadays, because you have moved out of statistics, moved around the industry. So tell us a little bit about your career since you left statistics.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so it's been a while since we spoke. Obviously, at the time that we had spoken, I was kind of transitioning out of stats and exploring roles outside of just pure kind of biometric, pure statistics role. So at the time that we had spoken, I was covering partly real-world evidence, but partly also things like integrated evidence and other kind of other business, core business functions. But since then, I have actually moved into a proper kind of real-world evidence role, which is still fairly technical and still requires a lot of the statistical knowledge and the epidemiological knowledge of things. But since then, I have actually then transitioned into real-world evidence. And soon, over the next few weeks, I'll be transitioning into yet another role, which is going to be, again, very different from kind of purely technical real-world evidence kind of role. But yeah, no, it's been an interesting transition. But the one thing I would say is that as a statistician, it has really, all of the skills are so transferable. Everything that you learn as a statistician while you're training, as a programmer, as, you know, whatever, whichever technical kind of expertise you have, those skills are super transferable. And they're always very, very helpful in whichever kind of direction you move. Because every time an interviewer asks, like, you know, what is your key strength? My standard answer is I have, you know, obviously good interpersonal skills, but the fact that I understand how to interpret data, how to actually present it in a meaningful way, that is, I feel, is what clinches the deal. Like, you know, because there's very few people who are good at who are good at both. And I feel like statisticians, given the right training, can be in that field where they understand the data, but you can also understand strategy for the company. So it's been good. It's been helpful to have been a statistician.
That is also, I always kind of tell people about that, and since they shouldn't take things for granted, yeah, just because it's easy for them, it's not easy for others. So let's talk a little bit about these two skills that you mentioned, understanding data. So could you contrast what is your experience of colleagues outside of statistics that are not statisticians mm-hmm. with their background? Where do they struggle with understanding data that we find potentially completely normal and kind of don't think a lot about it? Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's really this what we call the simpler thing that really stump a lot of people on the other side who don't have that statistical training. So for example, I'll talk about something which I think is a bugbear of all statisticians, like p-values, right? So, you know, oftentimes statisticians themselves recommend against kind of presenting p-values for certain reasons, because the data context is probably not right. The question of interest is not the one that will get addressed with a p-value presentation, for example. But oftentimes, with the minimal kind of stats training that people in the on the other end, maybe the audiences have, they're very much used to things like looking at p-values, looking at ratios, you know, percentages, for example. Whereas if, as a statistician, if I was to recommend against that, that is where a lot of people don't understand why we would say something like that. Another example is things like hazard ratios, especially in pharma, hazard ratios, incidence, risk ratios, things like that, which the interpretation can often be a little bit difficult for somebody who's not trained in kind of formal statistics. So I think it is our responsibility as people who have been trained in stats to make it as simple and digestible as possible. So speak in English, basically, to the person who's listening, rather than telling them, oh, this is a risk ratio, without really explaining what it actually means in terms of the context. Mm. But I feel like just the simple stuff that we take for granted, like you said, p-values, risk ratios, hazard ratios, you know, models, the different kind of regression models, things like that, a lot of people get stumped on that. And because they're stumped, often they're senior people, they don't also want to say that they don't understand it, which is where, like, you know, the clash of communications often happens.
Yeah. I think another area is when people talk about data. Yeah.
Yes.
We as statisticians see the complete chain of data. Yeah.
From
the case report form or the claims database or wherever it's collected up to the summary statistics. And we understand that you can also create lots of other summary statistics with the same data. Yeah.
Exactly.
And or you can look into other data sources, all these kind of different things. That is very often not that quite understandable for others.
Exactly. Oh, you're 100% right. I think when we say data, you're right. I think, you know, you get a visual in your head suddenly, right? When I mentioned the word data, I get, like, you know, tables in my head. I usually get the image of a raw data set, usually one that needs to be cleaned. Other statisticians might get a different image, but that's what I get in my head. And that for me is data. But I assume that somebody in a managerial or strategic kind of role, when they think data, they think of the final output, like a chart or a table. For them, that is data, maybe even written out. But for me, I'm thinking, when you say, you know, get exactly that, when I think data, it's like this unclean, like, you know, spreadsheet of, you know, raw data set. For me, that is data. But yeah, you're exactly right. So when they say that, you know, the data is not ready, for example, they don't actually mean that the data is not there. It's that the final output is not what's, you know, is not what's ready, for example.
Yes, that's a lot of things about that. Oh, we don't have the data yet. And you think, like, well, we have database.
Yep, we do.
Or we have the data.
Exactly. Yes. That's what I'm thinking. Like, yes, we have the data. Yeah, it's not clean yet. It's not been analyzed yet, but we have the data. Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah. The other is the communication of data. So you mentioned as a statistician, you have been trained in that and you have put a lot of emphasis yourself on that. How has that helped you in roles outside of statistics?
You mean the communication kind of training?
Yeah.
Oh, it's helped so much, because I feel, Alex, like, you know, when somebody in a technical role and not even just stats, not even statisticians, let's say epidemiologists or somebody working in real world evidence, for example, I feel like what we focus on when we are communicating data is the logic behind it, the methodology behind it, you know, the techniques, the details, which we are very much proud of, because, you know, we have taken this raw data set and turned it into this amazing, you know, result. So for us, when we're communicating that, we often tend to start with all of, you know, this was the background, this is what we did, this is the methodology. We really go into all of that backstory first. And then towards the final end of that communication, we get to, this is the final, this is the piece of the story. What I found, and through very hard lessons, I can assure you, it's been hard lessons, because I've had, you know, when you're speaking to an audience, you can see when the audience is starting to disengage. So I was on the stage, for example, and I'm looking at my audience, and some of them are not listening. Some of them are on their phone, especially as I'm talking about my amazing model that I had put in place. Interesting, you know, people are drinking water, not listening, like, you know, looking at their phones. And I'm just like, okay, I'm losing the audience. And I think after those kind of initially almost embarrassing and difficult situations where, you know, nobody is listening to you, I've kind of learned the hard way that I need to start with the final piece at the start. And I would say that the training and communication, kind of just practicing public speaking, speaking to different kind of stakeholders, has really helped kind of drive that home. Because as I started doing that, I just started noticing how much people are more engaged, because the hook is at the start. You know, if you keep the hook at the start, you're not going to lose your audience. And that's the one thing that the teachers in you know, Toastmasters that I practice public speaking at, is your title, for example, the title of your speech, and the first few lines that you say will either hook your audience or you will lose them for the next 10, 15 minutes, whatever it is. So this same thing for us, for stats and, you know, epidemiologists, that we need to start with the hook, like, this is what it's going to do. This is what this data is going to kind of, if you're looking to increase sales, for example, or drive prescriptions of something, you say, this is what we have found and this is how this can help. And then you go back into how we got to that conclusion. So yeah. I feel like statisticians are always focused on how, and kind of the management and the other stakeholders are focused on the why. And that, you know, why did you do this versus how I did it? It's completely different stories that we are saying. So yeah, but that communication training really helped kind of for me to understand the why for my audience.
Yeah, completely agree. In university, we learn this approach that kind of builds on, okay, where are the assumptions? Where are you coming from? Blah, blah, blah. And then we get to the conclusions. And in business, yeah, like in, you know, in magazines and so on, there's a headline, and a really, really kind of good first paragraph that basically tells the whole story, and then you go into the more details. You will not find in the BBC or the Times or any of these papers, you'll never find an article that's structured like a typical academic article.
Yes, exactly that. Like, they always start with X out of, you know, 10 people, X out of Y people have, you know, this kind of cancer in the last, or the incidence of cancer has gone up by X in 10,000 people in the last 3 years. That is such a major hook that, you know, we start with that. If our data set, the analysis was, let's say, incidence of something, if we start with that, that's hook right there, right? Yeah. I mean, you can't argue with a good hook.
Yeah. A good hook, it can be a statement. A question, or something that provokes some kind of reaction. Yeah, curiosity, something like this. Yeah, that's always great. Yeah.
Yes, 100%. One of the things I learned at Toastmasters is there's many ways to start your hook, to get your audience hooked in. So you can start with something completely, you know, let's say if you have got a humorous speech that you want to give your audience, you start with a very sad statement, for example, because people are completely not expecting that. And that catches the attention, and that you can repeat throughout your presentation or throughout your speech. It's like everybody's laughing and then suddenly you drop the mood and you just suddenly say, oh yeah, but you know, that my dog died, for example. And then just everybody who is not listening, they will suddenly come back into it and say, what happened? You know, we were just laughing a minute. It's just, you're exactly right. Like getting the emotional, understanding the emotional wavelength and, you know, playing with it. Just, you know, from a moment of, you know, a super kind of sad emotional speech or an emotional presentation, and then you suddenly go into a humorous part of it. It's just keeping people kind of not in a monotonous way.
Yeah. You could start a presentation about a study with, all patients treated with this will die.
Oh, God, yes.
And then say, yeah, but they will actually live much longer than before.
Yes. Oh, my God. You know what? That is true. That is, you know, oh, my God, that reminds me what I used to do at all my previous jobs when I was like a full-on statistician. I always started my presentations with a joke, like a statistical joke. And some of them were so bad, like terrible stats jokes. Like, you know, you've heard the one about, oh, you know, a girl who has a crush on a boy, and she goes to him and says, you know, how do I look? And he says, oh, you are average. And she says, oh, he's mean. No, I would put a terrible stats joke at the start, and everybody knew there was not going to be a boring, you know, old presentation about models. And even if it was, it still kept people engaged. So always thought, found humor, even if statisticians are not, you know, traditionally meant to be that way. I think that helps so much, so much.
Yeah. That's good. And by the way, ChatGPT can help you with lots of different hooks that you can create based on something you want to say.
That is true. That is exactly correct. And I feel like, I don't know if you've heard of the, you know, the kind of the ChatGPT engineering, obviously the prompt engineering. Sometimes I struggle with that. Like, I don't know, you know, for a speech, for example, that I need to give, and I ask ChatGPT, it comes up with a lot of great, like, you know, examples of things that I can use, but I feel like you really would need to use your brain a little bit to understand, because ChatGPT does not know who your audience is going to be. Yeah. But you're absolutely right. Use ChatGPT to get a start. It needs to be used in the way it was meant to be.
Yeah. To kind of get some creative inspiration.
Yes.
And go from there. Yep.
Exactly. Yep. Get the juices flowing.
Yeah. So in terms of the roles you have been in, so all of these roles had to do with data somehow, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, I would say definitely the current one is very much data-driven, data-focused. The previous roles have been kind of a mix of, you know, understanding the needs for certain kind of data generation versus not. But I feel like, as we were just talking before, that, you know, as companies evolve, pharma kind of is now recovering from the post-COVID era. There's a lot more, you know, patients are now going to see doctors. Everything is coming slowly back to normal. A lot of pharmaceutical kind of industry businesses are going back to the way things were before. So a lot of times statisticians and real-world evidence, for example, folk are not necessarily expected to work full-on with data, but rather on understanding why we need certain data sets, you know, kind of building relationships with data owners. So I would say that I've been lucky enough that my roles have always been, yes, they have been data-driven, but there has been a huge element of all the other kind of accessory roles that you need to do along with that.
Mm-hmm. How do you see the chances for statisticians compared to, well, non-data people in these other roles? Do you think you have some kind of advantage, or is it more of a disadvantage? What do you think?
Oh, 100% advantage. In my personal experience, it has been a huge advantage when I say, oh, I'm, you know, a statistician. I used to be a statistician. I was trained as one. That is a massive advantage because, like I said at the start, the skill of being able to understand data, being able to communicate it, that is a skill that is rare to find. Like, as much as we try to think, oh, you know, some consultant from, I don't know, some big, let's say, consulting firm, one of the big four, they can draw these amazing slides with, you know, amazing data sets. But really, it's the clients who need to understand that. So it's having that skill set of understanding what's being presented to you and you're not being taken for a ride, for example. I think that's a huge advantage. It's just going to be up to the statistician to use it to their advantage. But I think intrinsically, that advantage it's unbeatable.
Have you come across any situations that you really struggled a lot with?
Oh gosh, yes. So again, going back to my stats days, like full statistician, I had just moved out of academia, which was, you know, very
no,
much
no, in your non-stats times.
So. In my non-stats time, as in struggled with the expectations that people had.
Yeah.
Okay. To be honest, the expectations were kind of going backwards. So, you know, once you're kind of established as the next statistician or, you know, somebody who has the knowledge, even if you're in a non-stats role, sometimes people still associate that with you, that, you know, you still can understand all of this technical, you know, models and complicated programming, when really it's been a long time since we've done that, you know. So I sit in these meetings where, you know, people are, you know, presenting this very complex, let's say, you know, multifaceted model, and they look to you to see if, you know, you can make sense of some of it. And I am as confused as the next person, because I think stats is one of those skills. It's like you need to keep practicing at it. So if you want to be a good statistician, you need to keep up with, you know, everything that's happening. Once you're not a statistician, I think the focus is really on the other aspects of your role. But where I have really struggled as a non-statistician is kind of being associated still as having those technical skills. And I've really lost touch, to be honest. I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of expectations versus yourself. Yeah. So have there been situations where you were scared about, kind of you were asked to do something that scared you?
Yeah. I think it's almost a daily phenomena, you know.
Okay.
You always face these new situations that you have to present to some very senior leader, and you are kind of battling between what is it that I want to present to this person. And those are the situations, because it can usually be a hit or miss, right? The other person on the other side, you don't know who it is, right? You just know of this big boss, somebody up there who wants to know what you're doing. And you try your best to estimate what they want to hear. So that's something I try to do before the meeting or before I start my presentation, is try to understand what they would want to hear. So if I'm sitting in a meeting where I have to present my little work, you know, my little project to the senior people, I'd always, again, think about what they want to know. They are spending a lot of money, you know, contrary to popular belief, real-world evidence is not cheap. So, you know, it's this quick and dirty is not true. It's not true for real-world evidence. So they're sitting there paying, you know, a few millions for, you know, a secondary database study, let's say. I think that if I'm presenting to somebody like that, my fear is, am I giving them what they want? And I always try to estimate, thinking that they'll probably want to know, why am I paying all this money for this work? So my job is to show them that if you give me, you know, let's say $4 million for a study, how is that going to generate revenue or drive the sales of your product 10-folds, 20-folds, whatever. So my fear is, I want to make sure that the impact of my work is coming across. And if I don't break out of that mindset of the technical person or the stats person, I'm going to lose that opportunities. And those opportunities are very rare. Like, you get one chance, right? Yeah. So I would say, for me, that fear of not being able to communicate properly, to not being able to succeed in that communication is it's every day. You know, you always feel a little bit imposter inside, but you know, you give it a good shot. You try and estimate what it is that the other person is going to be interested to listen to.
Yeah, I think that is a great advice for any communication. Yeah. Always start with what's in it for the other person. Why should they care? Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you bring to the table? Yeah.
Yes.
These kind of things are really, really important. And Jeremy, I talk about exactly that in our leadership program. And
yes.
It's one of the absolute basics. And so often people more think about themselves in presentations.
Yes.
Rather
yes.
than about the audience, and in this case, kind of the senior decision maker, what they want to know.
Exactly. It's so contradictory, isn't it? It's like they say, oh, you have to go and present. And we take that opportunity to present our work as an opportunity for us to shine somehow. Like, you know, this is our one chance. We, you know, we become visible to our seniors. But really, I think that's such a loss, because, you know, they're not really interested in what you are, what you're doing. It's really how your work is going to help me. If it's a salesperson, they'll want to know driving numbers. If it's an access person, they'll want to know, how will this help me get access? So it's really all about the audience. But yeah, we sometimes get so mistaken about, you know, this is all about me, and to make ourselves shine, we put in all our models and all of our work. It's a waste. It's a waste.
Yeah, completely agree. When you think about stepping outside of statistics, how has that helped to progress for you from a career point of view?
I think it has definitely opened up a lot of doors, which were, you know, which initially I thought were not meant for me. So, for example, kind of looking at things like, you know, integrated evidence. Let's talk about that, because I've done a little bit of that in my previous roles. Initially, as before when I was, you know, still a statistician, I always felt that those kind of roles, you know, strategic, managerial roles, kind of very theoretical in their being. Those would not be the kind of roles, not only would I not enjoy, or those will not be open for me because I won't have those skill sets. But like I said, with me, it's always been, and this is an advice I got once when I was at university, my supervisor told me, if you like a job, just apply for it. He was like, don't look through the job requirements, look at the job description and then apply. So I followed that advice and I actually started putting myself out there for roles which I thought I was not qualified for. And turns out, like I said, the skills that we have as statisticians, they're extremely transferable. And sometimes we just put limits on ourselves saying, oh, I will never be able to do this kind of role, or they will not consider me, or I don't have the skill sets. That is a complete fallacy, because as statisticians, we are actually in a very strong position compared to many other people who, you know, who don't have the technical background or training.
Yeah. What have you enjoyed most as outside of that, from a kind of, you know, personal experience point of view?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like the thing is, personally, I enjoy speaking a lot, like public speaking and communication. So for me, having those opportunities to present my work, present myself to kind of more senior stakeholders, and not just senior stakeholders, but kind of cross enterprise stakeholders, that is something I have enjoyed a lot. And I know people would probably think, oh, come on, you know, who likes doing presentations, who likes speaking? But I actually have enjoyed it, mainly because I see it as a scientific thing. I don't see communication as, you know, something that's just humans do, because I've spent so much time kind of training myself to become a better communicator, like, you know, with Toastmasters and with other many other kind of speeches and things. I actually see it as a very scientific process. So yeah. For me, getting stuck into kind of communicating with others, not just in meetings, but even in one-to-ones, and understanding what it is that the other person needs from me and then putting that in place, I have really, really enjoyed that. So for me, it's been about not putting myself first. It's about putting others first. And I have, the way I've seen, like, you know, people's kind of eyes changing a little bit, like, you know, becoming that little bit bigger when you're speaking to them, because they're like, oh, I can use this, you know, suddenly something lights up in the head. I love seeing that. I love seeing how I can add value, because that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm just like, okay, at least I helped somebody today. So I have definitely enjoyed that aspect the most.
Yeah, awesome. However, I'm pretty sure you haven't always enjoyed public speaking.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, 100%. 100%. It's, you know, there's a saying that says, what is it? This is when I had first joined Toastmasters, and they were telling me that, you know, people would rather, they had interviewed a bunch of people like in a study, and they've asked them, what is it that scares them most? So on top of death, so it was not even, death was not even the first one, it was public speaking. So it's public speaking followed by being in a coffin, you know? So that really opened up my eyes, because the first time I did it, I was shaking. I was shaking on the stage, and it was just a 2-minute thing. Somebody just asked me to come up and just, you know, get comfortable to be on the stage and be the center of attention, because whenever you're speaking, the spotlight is on you. And a lot of us are not comfortable with that. So I think it's not even the fact that speaking is unenjoyable. It's being the center of attention, being in the spotlight. So what I started doing was, if somebody invited me up, I would just go and stand on the stage and say nothing, just get comfortable with like 20 eyes, 30 eyes all on me. And I think that's what scares people the most, because you're being watched by so many. So it's not even the speaking or your content, it's just getting comfortable being the center of attention. And as statisticians, sometimes as technical experts, we are very happy to kind of be in the background, you know, be part of the crowd rather than stand out. So I think if you get comfortable with that, that's okay. But yes, I have not always enjoyed it. I definitely not enjoyed being the center of attention.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing that. That means a lot to many people. Yeah, because as you just said, many people would rather die than speak publicly.
So, oh God, yes.
And that is not things that you can't break. Yeah.
Yeah.
By many, many little steps, pushing yourself out there, yeah, giving more and more presentations to bigger and bigger audiences.
Yeah.
You can turn that feeling around from really, really big fear into, yes, something that is enjoyable, that is fun. Yeah. And yeah, I completely agree. If you see people and say, nod with their head and say, kind of, you really see as these light bulbs go,
yeah,
on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is super rewarding. Completely.
Exactly. 100%. If you know whatever your content is, it lands, whether it's a professional setting or whether it's just, you know, casual communication setting. Once, exactly like you said, if you see what you're saying, it's landing on the other person's kind of radar, it's excellent, because that's the job done, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think, as a person outside of statistics, you have more channels, more platforms to reach a wider audience?
To be honest, I feel like probably not. I feel that statisticians and, you know, technical experts have kind of equal opportunities. Oftentimes we turn them down, I feel, because even when I was working as a statistician, I would be very happy for somebody else to present on my behalf than me doing it for myself. So I feel like the opportunities are more or less similar for kind of either statistician or non-statistician. It's just, are we good at taking those opportunities? Or are we good, like you said, at saying, let me do this, you know? And oftentimes we're not very good at doing that. And there's nobody to blame in that. It's just, a lot of times it's personality driven as well. Mm. But I would not say that non-statisticians don't have as much opportunities. It's just, we tend to just give it up and be very happy for somebody to put two slides on the stats bit and then present it, you know, without us coming forwards. I feel that's more the case.
Yeah, I think there is. And because of that, people kind of step back. That becomes kind of a habit and an expectation. Yeah.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. that, oh yeah, the non-statisticians will talk about all that because the statisticians don't want to speak up. Yeah.
Yes.
And from that, it becomes kind of a de facto rule that the non-statisticians present the data.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, and then it becomes sometimes really hard for statisticians to break through that.
Yeah.
Just because so many others before them or in their organization don't speak up.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly that. And it's such a missed opportunity there, because we have that. But also, I feel like as the reputation of statisticians changes in big pharma or in big industries anywhere, they are kind of, the invitations are forwarded the invitations to speak are forwarded to statisticians. We either don't take it, or if they are not coming to us, if the invitations are not coming, it's probably because of the reputation that statisticians have, that they'll just focus on the models and the details. We don't really want to know about all of that. So I think somewhere the responsibility is also on us as technical experts to change that perception, that, you know, when we send out pre-reads, for example, we don't put in like a bunch of technical details about how something was focused, really on the pieces that are impactful. And I think once somebody sees that, then why would they not invite us to speak? You know, it's just... Yeah. The responsibility lies also with the experts.
Okay, cool. So how do you have experienced working with statisticians as a statistician in the non-stats space?
Oh my, that is such a funny question. Yes, and it's a very valid one as well. And I feel like my respect for stats has gone up so much. Not even when I was a statistician did I think of the importance that I bring to a project as I do now. Like, there are so many kind of real-world evidence studies, real-world data sets, where I would not even think of setting up a project right from the start without having my stats partner with me. It's you know, my perception of myself as a statistician when I was one was completely different to how I'm seeing others. And I think that's a good point for statisticians to know, that we often tend to underestimate our own impact in mm-hmm. project meetings and in kind of bigger teams. As an ex-statistician, I can say I would not touch anything to do with data or with technical without a statistician present. So I think for me, my respect for stats as a core partner in any kind of meeting, any kind of project, has gone up like tenfold, even more than when I was one myself.
Awesome. That is so nice words that hopefully boost the confidence of statisticians out there. As I think that is often one of the reasons why people don't speak up. Lack of confidence is definitely something. Yeah.
Exactly. And the more that stats, kind of the statisticians and more kind of SMEs and technical experts kind of move away from, you know, just purely technical roles and they move more into management side of things, it's also their responsibility to make sure that, you know, how they feel about stats is then translated into practice. That, you know, they definitely demand that any new project must have a statistician from the outset, right? From the bat, instead of like, oh, now we have got the vendor, we have understood the protocol, now we'll have a statistician. It would not work that way. So I think as more of us kind of start, you know, we're getting older, we move into more senior positions, it's definitely our responsibility to make sure that, you know, stats is represented appropriately.
Yeah, I think it's a great strategy. Yeah. Develop people so that they can also leave statistics, join other functions within the organizations.
Yeah.
And that will help that data is better understood, better leveraged, there's better decision making based on data, all these kind of different things. So from my point of view, there can only be good things happening if we get more statisticians to work in other areas.
100%. That's going to change a lot of things. And like you said, it's to develop that kind of, you know, that thinking about the importance of stats. That can only happen when statisticians kind of put themselves out there and say, look, I'm eligible for this role. I'm actually going to be very good at it. They go ahead, apply, and they get those roles. And then it just changes everything. Because if somebody who's never been a statistician then becomes a manager of, you know, let's say real-world evidence teams, they will never see the importance. They will never know the importance of stats. So I think it's time statisticians kind of rise and say, you know, get their confidence kind of back. It's so needed. So needed.
Yeah. And statisticians can climb up very, very high. So I have seen the chief information officer, of Lilly.
Oh, wow.
Used to be a statistician. So she was directly reporting into the CEO, and had all IT and all these kind of different functions under her. Yeah. Or there's another CEO that I know that also ex-Lilly actually became a CEO of a biotech company. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we shouldn't say as statisticians we can't do these things. There are role models that
100%.
Have very, very successful careers outside of statistics.
Yes, absolutely. And anybody who can make that switch from technical to management, whoever can make that switch successfully, there's the world is their oyster. Like nothing can stop them because they have the best of both worlds. Like and that makes a unicorn. You know, you don't get people like that, very many of them. So
awesome. That is a very, very good final sentence. If you combine these management, these people skills with your technical data skills, you're really a unicorn. And so that will give you lots of opportunities, seize them. And as you said, you know, even if you think you are not qualified, that's just your perception. That's not reality. Yeah. And so ask for it. Yeah. What can happen? You may get a rejection here and there.
That's
very
it.
Often, if you don't ask, there's a no by default. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a no by default, 100%.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much, Swana, for this awesome discussion about what statisticians can actually achieve if they leave their comfort zone of biostatistics, biometrics, data science departments, and how much we can help our overall organizations to become more data-driven, have better decisions, communicate data better, and see all the different opportunities that we can do with data.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure talking to you, Alex. It's always a pleasure talking to you, but you know, this was a very appropriate discussion, and I feel the time is right because, you know, with the whole advent of kind of AI developing so fast, statisticians and anybody with a technical background is in such a great position. We just need to realize it and know that, you know, there's a lack of such skills. You have to go out right now. This is the time to really seize that.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Don't forget to check out theeffectivestatistician.com to learn about the upcoming conference that happens 7th, 8th, and 11th and 12th of November with all these different great interactive webinars, workshops. And of course, we have presentations, panel discussions, awesome keynote speakers, and all the other things as well. This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who help with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.